welcome to Writer's Blockbusters, the show where we treat the final edit of the movie like the script. I'm one of your hosts, Bob Rose, at Thundergrunt Bob on all the dumb social media. And right now, Jimmy's going to introduce himself.
I am Jimmy George. I am a screenwriter and script consultant. My Twitter handle is at Jimmy R. George.
And I'm Jamie Nash. My Twitter handle is at Jamie underscore Nash. I am a screenwriter and I wrote a book called Save the Cat Writes for TV and the Save the Cat Beat Sheet Workbook, which you can buy now.
And today, in celebration of Valentine's Day, I guess, right? That was the decision on this one.
Yeah.
In celebration of Valentine's Day, we're gonna talk about 10 things I hate about you, which
50
I feel
shades
like
of gray.
50 shades, no, 50 shades darker. We're doing 50 shades darker, the second one with the helicopter crash. That's what we're doing.
Wow, I didn't even know there was a helicopter.
There's a helicopter crash and a Chronicles of Riddick poster in the movie. Anyway, we're going to talk about 10 things I hate about you because we all had a big discussion on what we would do next, and it was Valentine's Day. We also talked heavily about the year 1999 being just a dynamite year for film. You know, so we'll probably revisit 1999 in the future, I think, as we discussed. But yeah, before we get to our talking points, we're going to go around and all of us white middle-aged men are going to tell you what we think about 10 things I hate about you from our personal life. Let's start out with Jamie.
Okay. 10 things I hate about you. This is a movie that early in my writing career I saw and was kind of influential to me. So I, like, when I was rewatching this the other night, I haven't seen it in many years. Maybe that's not true. But, like, my wife walked in and she was like, oh, it's your favorite movie, 10 Things I Hate About You. So it's a movie I really like and I talk about a lot. Partially, like, right when I started screenwriting, I saw it and the screenplay was available. And the writers showed up at Austin the first year I was at Austin. And all of those things kind of mixed together in that. And I was like Keith Ledger really popped in this movie. Like, I was like, who is this guy? And Julia Stiles really popped in this movie. You know, I am a big fan of this movie. I do like this movie. But I would say the screenplay was one when people used to ask me back in 2004, 2005, what screenplays should I read? You know, you always get that question. And I used to tell people to read the script because if you look at the actual pages of the script, it is like classically good. Like it's kind of like as a screenwriting teacher, it's fun to read. It has a lot of white space. It has good dialogue. It has this heightened dialogue thing. It's a really easy read. And it used to be the script I used to tell people to read. I probably don't as much anymore just because it's older, but I looked at it for this and it's still, I think it's lessons. If you actually read the screenplay, if you're new to screenwriting and you just want to get a feel for how you should write, I do think it strikes the right balance of being very sparse and fun. So that's my take on 10 things I hate about you.
Awesome. Jimmy.
So similar to Jamie, I started writing screenplays in 1999. That's when I decided that I wanted to try writing movies. And yeah, we've talked about in the past how there you didn't used to be able to find any script you wanted at any time for free with the click of a button. And this was on Drew's Scriptorama, which was like the original OG place where you could find some movie scripts online if you were lucky. And when I was first starting out and I wanted to know, you know, learn about the craft, there wasn't that much even out there on that subject, you know, that was readily available to somebody in Baltimore. So I was able to find this script online. It's one of the first screenplays I ever read. And it was, of course, very formative. I guess, considering what Jamie said, I picked a good one to learn from. What's really interesting that we're going to talk about later is actually how different the script that's available online is from the final cut. and really good screenwriting lessons to take from them. But the movie, I just love this movie so much. It uses all the tricks. There's so many techniques and tools that we talk about on this show that's not even on the list. That's how many techniques there are on display. Like, there's a classic confessional we're not going to talk about. There's multiple rules of three. There's handshakes. There's dialogue, repetition, and reversal. It's got all of this stuff that it's so good. We filled an entire episode with talking points, and we're not even going to talk about like 10 of the other techniques they use. So I, big fan of this movie.
You know, it's funny. The opening thing is supposed to be us not talking about the writing, and you both just spent the entire time talking about the writing. Anyway, I'm going to use my statement to say that I obviously love this movie, blah, blah, blah. It's a classic, blah, blah, blah. What I want to talk about, which has nothing to do with writing, is that it's a movie with a lot of great character actors in it of its time. Allison Janney, Larry Miller, David Leisure, a.k.a. Joe Isuzu. But most of all, I want to point to the one and only David Krumholtz.
Yes.
Star of Oppenheimer. Which is our last episode. This movie, like, okay, so this movie, it is a comedy. But, you know, I would say that as far as the actual laugh out loud moments, it's all carried on his back. Like, as far as being a funny movie, the actual main, like the main cast and their stories are fine. And they are funny in like a haha way. But David Krumholtz's performance in this movie literally makes every time I watch it, I say, we wasted this man.
Yeah, absolutely.
He should have been starring in leading roles in comedy movies for a very long time. Even at that age, he had masterful comedic timing. And I know he's had a great career. I mean, like, you know, Adam's Family Values, and he was in the Harold and Kumar movies. He's been
Numbers.
Numbers, Ballad of Buster Scruggs. The guy has worked. He's a great character actor. But every time I watch this movie, I'm always like, we wasted him. He could have been even more.
Yeah.
I'm glad that he's in Oppenheimer. But that, and he's kind of funny in Oppenheimer,
he
too,
is
right?
Funny enough.
Yeah, he's kind of funny in Oppenheimer. But I still feel like there could have been, not that he's dead, but there could have been more from him in a different way. Because the guy's comedic timing is on the level of, you know, some of the greats there, especially in this movie of all
time. Oh my God, the Chuck E. Cheese moment where he's talking about the last
you
want to
hear about a good time. Right, yeah, it's fucking good. He's good. He's really good. His delivery is so crisp in this movie. It's just like, how was he not even bigger? How is he?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's all I wanted to point to is David Krumholtz. And, yes, you know, I've been a fan forever, and this movie is like a perfect display of why he should have been more famous
than
he was.
So good.
Not that I'm sure he's happy with his career, and he should be. He should be proud. I'm not trying to say he's a failure or anything.
It's my favorite Larry Miller performance, too. I mean,
yeah, Larry Miller's incredible. David Leisure's on the screen for one fucking scene, and he kills it. You know, I'm going to take this too. Yeah, it's like he kills it, you know. It's got a lot of good character actors doing it surrounding these kids, you know, but I wanted to highlight Krumholtz because I don't even know if we mentioned him on Oppenheimer.
I know.
That's fine. We didn't have to, but yeah, like that's it. That's what I use my time for. David Krumholtz. Look up his name, watch his stuff.
Weirdly enough, like, so in this movie, like when Julia Stiles was in it, I probably saw all her movies after this just based on this movie. You know, I was like, oh, she's really good.
Jamie, and it was you watching Save the Last Dance is really a funny
idea. I think I did. But she kind of had a strange career that kind of, you know, it felt like she kind of vanished a little bit. But then I was in Universal Studios a couple weeks ago, and they have this Bourne ride. And she's like the face of the franchise for it. Like she's the one they got to be the, like, you know, Bourne is on a mission and blah, blah, blah. And there's no sight of Matt Damon or anything else. It's her. I mean,
that's
she's
so
the one.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hey, a check is a check, right?
Absolutely, dude.
But I've only seen like two Bourne movies, and I do remember her being, she's like the Nick Fury of those movies, right? Mm-hmm. Like she's the backbone of them.
Kind
good
of
her. I mean, it's a job.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Keep making those things. Good
yeah,
for her.
The weird thing is she's kind of like middle level management in those, as opposed to like the head of it or anything or the general.
Well, so is Nick Fury. Remember, he has uppers.
He does have uppers, but he still seems like he's more we're the one making some decisions and going rogue and stuff like that. Yeah. She's just kind of like the middle person. She's like Chloe on 24. If you ever saw 24, that's what she reminds me of. She's like that.
Hey, they made one with Jeremy Renner as the star. Make one with her.
They did.
Would be awesome.
Yeah. Where's her Bourne Identity?
Well, the Universal Studios is kind of it there.
That's what it is.
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, no, she doesn't have any action scenes or anything. She's more, she's more like, please make sure to buckle your seatbelts, or there's no seatbelts in it. It's a stunt show, but whatever, you know, like it's that kind of thing.
Is it when you're waiting in line, it's like the TVs?
It's the pre-show. Because the funny thing about that one is, unlike like Minions and all these other ones that they do, this one needs a lot of explanation. Like, I think they assume that a lot of people do not know the Bourne universe. So they really have to go into the whole thing. Like, he lost his memory and then he lost his love and now he's on the road. And they have to tell you the whole entire backstory of Bourne. It's pretty funny. I'm just like, oh, they had to jump through a lot of hoops to do this stunt show.
Not a fan, to be honest. It's the camera work, not the writing.
Shaky cam.
I don't like shaky cam. And that's the series of shaky cam.
The stunt show, not to make this all about the Bourne stunt show.
Yeah, I was going to say, all the topics.
Yeah. The stunt show was kind of amazing because what they do is it's a stunt show in front of a volume like Mandalorian uses. And you see how great those screens are when you're sitting like 30 feet away from them, because you cannot tell the difference between the screen and a set. You just can't. And they do all this stuff where they mix and match like the screen and the set. For that reason, it's really impressive. The technology is impressive.
So all our listeners, forget, you know, writing your script this year for a week and go see the Bourne stunt show.
It was cool.
Take your family on that and enjoy. And sponsored by them.
Yes. And skip the Fast and the Furious ride. It's really bad. Okay. And they have Vin Diesel and everybody in that one, but it's not good. Not good.
Jamie doesn't want to do a script podcast. He just wants to make lists of things. <That's cool. laughs> Here's the list of my top 10 and top worst rides.
Let's analyze Universal for its story structure within
Those have scripts.
I have friends that have worked on those, especially like the pre-show line and stuff like that.
The making of the Guardians thing on Disney Plus.
It was awesome.
James Gunn talks about writing the ride. You know, it does have a script.
It's a great.
Anyway, okay. Okay. Focus. We got a lot to talk about. Jamie, who wrote this shit?
Yeah, Karen McCullough and Kirsten Smith, who we talked about in Legally Blonde, I assume.
Great episode.
And I'm sure this came up, but again, early in my screenwriting career, they were in Austin, very accessible, very friendly, very cool, made the career seem like something attainable. So I was a big fan right away, and I had just come off seeing this movie maybe a year or two earlier. So anyway, after that, they wrote this, I believe, on spec. I'm pretty sure. Can't say I fact checked that, but I'm 99.9% sure it was a spec screenplay that they eventually sold. They were kind of thinking like Clueless, you know, had the whole Jane Austen thing. So they were going to do Taming of the Shrew in a similar way. And this was the movie that launched their career, even though they worked on a TV series prior called Getting Personal. But anyway, they are a team. They did movies like 10 Things I Hate About You, of course, Legally Blonde, Ella Enchanted, She's the Man was one of their movies. Mm-hmm. The House Bunny was a movie they worked on.
Love The House Bunny.
I think that was Anna Faris had the character idea, and she brought it to them, and they worked on it with her. And then after that, their career fades a little bit. Like, I don't know The Ugly Truth, I guess I know. There's something called Trinkets, which I'm not sure what that is, but Kirsten Smith apparently was one of the creators of that based on a book.
And probably endless things that just didn't come to fruition.
I'm sure they were on everything. I watched an interview before this it's funny because it reminded me of the interview I saw years ago. They were at like a festival or something, and they were working on the Expendables female edition or something.
Oh, that's awesome.
This was back in 2012, so it must have never happened. But
Yeah.
And honestly, I think that would make a great stunt show at Universal.
Get your tickets now. Sorry, what was the box office on this, Jamie?
Yeah, the box office domestically was like 38 million. So it finished. So it wasn't like a huge blockbuster or anything. I think it probably took off more after that and sort of was critically and acclaimed and sort of critically acclaimed and the fans and only 53 million worldwide, because movies like this probably don't travel as well as the Expendables with women.
Right.
Or Bourne.
This feels like it was like it lived on cable. Like that's right. I didn't go see it in the theaters. But I saw it a billion times on cable.
Yeah. I think I saw it on DVD. I don't think I saw it in the theater either.
Yeah. But would it be too far to call it a cult classic, even though it's not a flop? It's not a flop.
It definitely took on a bigger life, Austin Powers style, once it hit the video stores. Right. You know,
we
just never got the Spy Who Shagged Me of 10 Things I Hate About You.
They had TV show and
they did have it. Yeah. There was a TV show.
Yeah.
There were a ton of movies like this in the 90s. Cause you know, my wife and I watched every single one of these Same. Movies in the 90s. So, but this is the one for me that's my favorite of all of these type of movies. This was my favorite back
mine
then.
Too.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's mine, but it's up there.
Yeah, I can't it's think high. Of what would beat it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not gonna sit here and ponder that right now and burn the time for you guys.
Let's list them and
And number one is all right, let's talk Triple Bump Catalyst.
Well, speaking of listing, we are going to get Jamie to list a shit ton of stuff now.
His favorite activity.
So one of the things that stuck out to me when I was, you know, my first rewatch, I rewatched this a couple times for the show, is that I think it has, we've talked about in the past, the double bump catalyst, which we're going to get Jamie to explain. But I actually think this has a triple bump catalyst, maybe even more. But Jamie, do you kind of want to just go into your... And Jamie had recently told Bob and I he had this new list of different types of catalysts. So this was perfect timing to like talk about it.
He's always telling us about his new list.
I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this particular one, I'm getting ready for a Save the Cat webinar, which you can sign up for still. I guess it'll be like the week after this podcast it starts. So I'm getting ready for that. So I started to make some new material Save the Cat wise. So this is a list I came up with to help with catalysts. it's my catalyst.
Save the catalyst.
Yeah,
I love it.
If you use that, I want some money.
We got there. Save the catalyst.
Save the catalyst. Let's talk about double bump catalysts first. And the weird thing about the double bump catalyst is it was in Blake's third book. He talked about a double bump catalyst. If you don't know what a catalyst is you start in a movie and you start in the ordinary world and something suddenly happens to the hero that kicks off the story. Something, you know, almost coincidental, out of the blue, something sudden that's eventually going to take them from their ordinary world to this quest or, you know, situation or tale or whatever that happens. It's the first thing that kind of strikes the hero. And that's what a catalyst is. And in Blake's third book, he talked about a double bump catalyst, which is when you kind of have two things that have to happen to kind of rock their world and put them on the path of the story. They're almost like two sudden events. Now, here's the weird thing. Like when I look up the ones in that he gave as an example or people that worked with him gave as examples back in like 2010, 2011, 2012, when he first kind of was talking about this. I don't know that I totally buy into the double bump catalyst the way they present it. The way they present it was almost like like, I think Blake might have given the example of Luke Skywalker. So he sees the message from Princess Leia, but then it takes his parents getting killed to go on the quest. To me, that's more just the debate and an event that happens in the debate and then the break into two. I don't know that that's a double bump catalyst to me. It's all kind of part of the same thing. It's not like, it's just a development of the first catalyst in some ways. It's kind of like all part of the same thing. So anyway, that's just my nitpickiness. Whereas like a movie, like the one I always point to is like Happy Gilmore. You need two things to happen. You need two random events. One random event is, what is it? His grandmother's going to lose the house or something like that.
Grandmother's going to lose the house. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one event. The second random coincidence that's not really related, in my opinion, to the two, they could have happened opposite, is
that he can drive, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So he gets that opportunity. That to me is more of a double bump catalyst when I think of it, as opposed to, and honestly, who cares? Like, you know, whether one's or not, my point is you can have any number of catalysts up on your way to the break into two. There can be three, there can be four, there can be seven. For all I know, as long as they don't feel too coincidental. Like if you have seven random, like he gets struck by a meteor and then he gets struck by lightning and then he wins the lottery and it's, and the movie's not about that. Well, then it gets weird.
And a spoof movie that would work pretty good.
And a spoof movie that could work. for sure. So with that in mind, I made a list of types of catalysts, and I certainly don't think this is a comprehensive list, because every time I watch a movie, I'm like, oh, I wonder where that one fits. But I also don't want to make a list of like 1,000 of them. I wanted to keep it kind of contained, you know? So I tried to make them a little vague so they could encapsulate. So what I'd like to do is I was going to read some and give you examples. And then if you recognize one from this movie, why don't you stop me and call it out?
Okay.
All right. Yeah.
So just keep in mind, I kind of stacked the bad ones. Like there are some that are positive things that happen to your hero. They come later, and there are bad things that happen. I put those early. So the first few probably aren't in our movie. Okay. So here we go. Number one, I have Unleashed Horror. Okay. And for this one, a terrifying force suddenly attacks. They threaten the hero or hero's world. So this could be Jaws or Scream or even the Avengers or something like that. So something horrible happens. I don't think there's one of those in this movie.
You could argue metaphorically, like the first time he sees how attracted he is to her, that's like the unleashed horror. But that's not horror.
Yeah. You know? If we stretch that to mean that, then I'd only need one. That's it. We're done. Right. So anyway, so Bad Mood Moon Rising is the next one. And this one is the first hint of trouble on the horizon. And it's funny, I know there's a million of these, but the first thing I could think of is Deep Impact or something like that. Like we see the meteor,
right away,
it's coming to get us. And I don't think there's one of those either.
No.
They're here. This is a supernatural or paranormal experience foreshadowing a problem of otherworldly proportions. In some ways, this is similar to Bad Moon Rising. My only difference is this one doesn't have to be scary for the heroes necessarily. This could just, you know what I mean? This isn't necessarily, maybe the audience knows this is bad stuff, but so again, I don't think we have that one. The other one I have is called Taken. And there's 11 of these, we're on four. So the hero or someone close is taken, leading to a quest for rescue or return. So The Wizard of Oz, Finding Nemo, Taken, Toy Story. So it's either you get taken away, swept away, or some person in your world gets taken. And that's kind of the first thing that happens.
Still nothing.
They're coming, I promise. Identity crisis. This is kind of like that, you know, case of wrongful identity, wrongfully accused kind of thing. The Fugitive, Minority Report, North by Northwest. So it's any kind of, they got the wrong person. They point at the wrong person for some reason, whether it's confusion, framing, whatever. Number six, life sucks. So a sudden drastic event, life event, disrupts the protagonist's world, leading to significant change. This could be a relationship, divorce, sickness, or even sudden financial ruin. So some examples would be like Up, anything with a death, like Manchester by the Sea, or something like that, or anything where suddenly everyone's money goes away or something. Happy Gilmore could be another one. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. We're almost there. Yeah. We're almost there. So seven is you shouldn't have seen that. Characters witness something they weren't meant to see. Okay. So Rear Window, Fright Night, Enemy of the State, something like that. Eight is what I call you're a wizard or something. And this is when some kind of secret is revealed about the hero that they're the one or something like that. Or even ones like History of Violence, where the hero knows the secret, but somehow it's revealed or bad stuff or comes Bourne, because of their secret.
Right? Because Bourne is him discovering he's a spy.
Bourne could be that.
The amnesia aspect of it.
Barbie is another one. Like, there's this deep secret about her existence, you know, that she starts to there's something going on as far as those go. So now we're in the positive ones, the last three. And I think these are the ones we may find some things. So the first one is the meet cute. This is, you know, characters have a charming and humorous first encounter that sparks a significant relationship.
So we definitely, this is one of them. Yeah.
Except, you could argue this has two of them.
It's funny that the one that I consider the actual catalyst, though, is he doesn't actually meet her. He just sees her, but it counts, right?
That counts.
Because he becomes his French tutor, her French tutor off screen.
Right.
Michael and David Krumholtz's character says, forget her. It's widely known that the Stratford sisters don't date. So there's your, that's the first spark. Boom. You know, like, you need
how,
that
how do we
part
figure this out?
Yeah.
But yeah, there is like three meet cutes in the movie, right?
There's more than one. Yeah. But this is the one that's like plot driven, you know, the A story. Yeah.
And this one's a true blue meet cute because he literally meets her for the first time, where all the other characters I think have met before. I think.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Heath Ledger
hasn't met her yet.
Is that true?
No, they're in class together. They imply that they've been sharing space together.
Yeah, they're really in each other's worlds or paid attention to each other before.
Yeah,
they're
on each other's
loose
radars.
Acquaintances.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 So the next one is the big windfall, a sudden, surprising win, opportunity, positive situation, or situational change falls in the hero's lap. And these are like Little Miss Sunshine, Simple Plan, Home Alone.
The rules, right?
Yep, the rule. The fact
there's a way around it. Yeah, the dad's rules.
He says, old rule out, new rule, Bianca can date when she does. So I think that's catalyst number two. I think that's, you need that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And then last but not least is we've got a job for you. And this is heroes are assigned an offer, our critical role, task, or mission, setting the stage for an adventurous journey. So Oppenheimer, Seven, Blade, James Bond, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Patrick Verona.
right. Yeah.
Yep.
That is the movie.
Yeah. We have a job for you. You see that girl? That's Kat Stafford. I want you to go out with her. I can't take out her sister until Kat starts dating. So bam.
Now, in relation to this, because I think, so three catalysts there. Here's the big question I had when watching this movie now with my 2024 eyes and 2024 brain. And this movie is structured weird in some ways. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like it at all. And my memory had it as like a perfect structure, right? It's like, it's like a simple movie, simple structure. And I don't think it's complex at all. So question one that came up, who is the hero of this movie? Who is the main character of this movie, or who are the main characters of this movie?
Bob, you want to go and then I'll go.
It's a hard question, right? I think because Joseph Gordon-Levitt or Heath Ledger is what it feels like. One of those two.
Yeah.
I would lean Heath Ledger and Bianca, or not Bianca. What's her name? Kat.
Kat.
Yeah, I would lean that they're. Heath Ledger's the hero, but it's hard to tell.
So
it's kind of fuzzy with this movie.
It's it there's like a handoff almost.
So it's
a hand, yeah, there is a handoff.
Right? I think there's two things that are that make it weird. Number one, it's an ensemble drop. Yeah. It's an ensemble story. Yeah. It's a true ensemble. We really follow the storylines of like six different people. But more than that, what's weird and unconventional, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but I think it's Kat's movie, but she, and I don't think she's passive, but everything that drives the story is Patrick and Cameron's plan. So yeah. Patrick and Cameron are the one with the goal and agenda and the plan. And the entire movie is basically how is she going to respond to that plan and to their efforts to manipulate
You could even say, how are the sisters going to respond to the plan?
Well, the sister ends up being part of the their team, like she's helping them giving them information.
But I was saying, as far as how it feels, it also feels like how are
like
the
how is
gonna
Bianca gonna respond?
Respond to all this? That's true. Even knowing
it's weird because she's not a passive protagonist, but she does not have an agenda as the hero. But I feel like it's her story. I mean, especially since it's a Taming of the Shrew retold, and she's the Shrew. And in Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew is the main character. So, it's weird. It's fucking weird.
I feel like the movie is on her side, too, if that makes any sense. You know what I mean? Like, everyone that thinks she's horrible, but the movie doesn't think she's horrible. The movie kind of understands her and, like, validates her in every way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, she's not horrible at all. Like,
She's not.
Yeah, it's like when people say she's scary, it's just because she doesn't tolerate fools.
In 2024, she's just she's like more normal than ever. She's more normal than anything.
For sure.
Jamie, you had mentioned, and I think we should go through the beats. It's interesting that when because I wasn't going to talk structure, and then you brought it up, and I was like, well, let's look at it, and it did. It was interesting how it sort of keep going.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the only other thing I'd say about the hero, the other part that, in my opinion, confuses it. So I think it totally starts out, like if I was mapping this like minute for minute, I'd be like, oh, it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt's,
The movie opens?
Levitt's movie. It opens with him. He's a fish out of water.
Well, she's actually the first character we meet in the car, which that's I was true. Like surprised to yeah. see. She's that's the true. First character. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. She.
I kind of forgot that scene.
The skateboarder and all that stuff. But he's introduced, you know, he gets the. Here's the school. It's kind of that Mean Girls intro or whatever, which happened later, I guess. But he walks through. It's his plan. She's the obstacle in some ways. He's trying to overcome obstacles. He's trying to get somebody to date. You know, the obstacle is he has to find somebody to date the sister and all that stuff. So it feels like that at first. But then Heath Ledger becomes the guy who gets the we've got a job for you, right? That's his sudden catalyst. And he goes off and it kind of becomes his obstacle is breaking through her resistance. And then he has a goal. He's an active hero. But then in the end, the arc focuses on her, like, which is really strange. And we're going to talk about the end, but then there's also a strange thing where she's the aggrieved party, but she's the one that does the biggest grand gesture in the end, which is really odd in some ways. You know, she's the one that reads that really touching poem and everything. Whereas you'd almost expect it to be Heath Ledger's character would need to do that to win her over.
He already did it like earlier in the movie, kind of, right?
He did, but like
sort of. He did his.
But
grand
you couldn't
gesture,
have
yeah.
him do something big again because
yeah,
he did the big.
He already
thing
did
already.
The big thing. Yeah.
But the problem was, did he do it just because he was on a bet? We don't know. You know, we don't. I mean,
no,
she doesn't
I know.
Know. Yeah,
she
that's
doesn't
weird,
know.
But
yeah,
she
we
doesn't
know.
Know that.
Yeah,
like,
we know
that. Like she did nothing wrong. She fell for him. She was with him. She was at the prom with him, and then. Like she has to, it's a weird thing. It's strange.
It's very
to me.
Weird. No, Jamie, it's you had mentioned like a handoff. When we get to the act three, I kind of feel like it is they collectively each character makes the same kind of traditional arc plot emotional experience. They each have their own little piece of it, and we feel like we're watching like a normally structured movie as a result, but it's actually really strange. Like, yeah, we get all the same tastes and flavors that we normally get, but they're not coming from one character. They're kind of coming from the ensemble's experience. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of is why it works.
It kind of feels like two movies, right?
Yeah,
a little
yeah.
bit. It feels like you could have written two pretty good movies.
It feels
in
like
there somewhere. It you feels know, the like Joseph Gordon-Levitt and then the Heath Ledger one.
It,
you know?
It feels like. And why don't we just jump into the?
Yeah,
and by the
go.
Way, by the way, if you want to talk about anything, this is really going to hit the third act a lot. So I can't remember if you have any talking points about the third act outside of this. I guess you
no.
Don't.
I all I did was I figured if we want to talk about, since we're talking about like structure. There's kind of a clear lock-in, and it's not Cats, you know, which is like, I think the end of Act One
mm-hmm.
is like, it's kind of like a two-handed end of Act One. It's like a two-parter. Patrick asks Kat out, and she rejects him, which happens mm-hmm. at exactly 25% of the movie.
Yep.
You know, your
yep.
traditional mm-hmm. arc plot, and then the next scene, Cameron and Michael reveal to Patrick that they're the ones behind this plan. Michael says, "We set this whole thing up. Joey is just a pawn." And Patrick says, "So you two are going to help me tame the wild beast," which is the big trailer line. So that's kind of the lock in, right? All three of them are on the plan together. And that is not Kat's lock in, you know, that is mm-hmm. Cameron. She, and yeah.
I mean, she's definitely the obstacle, but it's a little bit like Back to the Future, right? Where it's almost like they have to, for better lack of a better term, they have to arc her in some
yeah.
ways. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
They have to convince her.
It's like
they
it's
have to force an
this,
arc.
This yeah. story is going to force growth. Yeah.
It's going to
yeah.
force growth in her, where she's yeah. not the active one. She's the obstacle and she's resisting.
It's weird.
Also,
we're
it's
following
also
the agents of change, right? Like,
but you could, okay. You could also argue though that there's agents of change pushing Heath Ledger too.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like this, that's
they're
also
all,
happening.
That's what, I, there's like later in the talking points they have.
Okay. Sorry.
No. It's okay.
Every single one of them changes over the course of this. Cause what they're doing yeah. isn't, I don't know, ethical, I guess, or, you know,
yeah.
it's not on the level.
All,
it's a bad thing
gonna,
to do.
They're all going to come of age through this experience.
Yeah. So they yeah. all kind of learn something and soften and kind of get other people empathy toward the other yeah. people. So, outside of that, there are really three things I highlighted. One is there is a midpoint, which Blake calls sex at 60, moments. There's two of them in this. And so I thought it would be worth highlighting those because they're definitely here. So sex at 60 was a term that they used to use back in the old days of movies, like in the 50s and stuff. Whereas that would be at the midpoint. That's where the kiss or the love scene or something, probably in the 50s
okay.
it was a kiss. So whatever that first moment where they kiss or they... Now, the interesting one is the... that you see a lot is the almost kiss is also mm-hmm. very popular. And this one, I think we have kind of both from both sides. On one hand, we have like a true sex at 60, like a kiss. And the other one, we have an almost kiss. So there's like double mm-hmm. midpoints for the two parallel stories. And what those scenes do, like why that's interesting is once that happens, like say for, now, it's interesting, the almost kiss, it forces the bad guys close in because now Kat thinks she wants nothing to do with Heath Ledger's character. You know, she kind of goes away. But at the same time, the almost kiss shows that now for Heath, it's personal. It's not about money. So when people are giving him money, he's like, "I don't want to play your game anymore." And he's mm-hmm. struggling with the fact of playing.
He's
the
gaining.
Game
he's growing.
He's
yeah.
growing.
Yeah.
So it's causing both external, her, and internal his own like kind of despising of what's going on. Bad guys close in.
And then Cameron's side of it, the Bianca's changing and Cameron's mm-hmm. like speaking up for himself and having self-respect. So he has his own kiss too. And that's like you said, like, so both of those,
she's no longer without. She now is with
it's this great dual midpoint that I didn't anticipate, you know, when we were revisiting. It's cool.
Yeah. And so even though they're on a positive trajectory, what that shows now is up to this point, he really didn't have anything to lose. Like it was a, he was a underdog, you know, it was like a long shot that he would ever get with Bianca. Now he has something to lose. So he has to be more cautious throughout the movie and do things the right way or something, or he might lose. He might lose badly and have a personal loss. Where before, if he lost, hey, he just didn't get Bianca. It wasn't going to happen.
He was at zero anyway.
He was at zero, but now he does. Yeah. He has something to lose. So anyway, that's there. It's two good examples of this Sex at 60 moment happening. By the way, it used to be 60 because movies were always 2 hours, but it's really just the midpoint. That's just the handle
this,
for whatever.
This is at 52 minutes, by the way.
Yeah,
which is about exactly halfway. Yeah,
it's just a handle that Blake uses in his book.
Really unfortunate named term.
Yes,
sounds not right.
I think it's almost I think it's purposefully ironic in that way.
When you put it on there, I was like, "What is this?"
Yeah, I think
like I want to write a Viagra movie and then it's real sex. It's
yeah. Yeah. I think it's purposefully like that because whenever it comes up, you always have to kind of get through the joke. For whatever reason, you remind me of these horrible commercials. So now I have to go down that tangent. Have you ever seen these commercials? I can't remember what they're for, but they said Mom and I had to have the talk. And the people are like 50 years old, like talking to their 80-year-old parent.
Yeah.
And the mom goes, not that talk. And it's like, who wrote this? Like, anyway. But they're like, it's like somebody my age. Because the talk is about getting mom in like a nursing home or something, right?
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah. But they have like 50 commercials like this that all do the same joke. Like they like somebody wrote this joke and thought it was the funniest damn joke they ever thought to the point where anyway, it drives me crazy. This is the only place I can talk about it. So every time I see it, I remember them, and they are awful. Who thought up this and why did they, I could see using it once and being like, that was the worst idea ever, but they have like 50 commercials that start with the same joke. It's like their tagline for this company is like, we have the talk, not that talk.
Whenever you encounter this term for screenwriting, you're going to think about these commercials now. Because I did. Yes. So I'm sorry.
I don't know why that put me. Because the people are like 60 years old, and it's like, we finally had the talk. It's like, what? They're 60 years old. who thought? Nobody thought that. Okay.
It could be like a Steve Carell 40-year-old virgin thing.
It is weird. It is weird. Yeah. So anyway, seek out that commercial and be outraged like me. So the next one I want to talk about, and this one maybe is debatable from something I know Jimmy said later on. I think this one has a very classic romantic comedy, all is lost moment.
Mm-hmm.
However, because of what happens in Act 3, which I don't think there is much of an Act 3, I think it's very abbreviated. It makes me debate if I should look at this in a different way. Like if this isn't the all is lost moment at all. However, I will say the moment when they find out that it's all a bet at the prom, when everything seems to be going great, is almost like vintage, classic, instructional, all is lost moment. Like if you have a story about two people that are going to sort of fall in love under a ruse, all is lost is almost always going to be, it's revealed, the ruse is revealed, and they break up. Most romantic comedies, when they hit the all is lost, the worst possible thing that could happen to that relationship happens. It confirms their flaws. And they break up, you know, and that's what happens at all is lost. And that's what happens here at the prom when it's revealed that the whole thing was like a gag. However,
in Act Three, that moment that you're describing.
What's that? What's that?
Yeah. I think that's in Act Three. So to that point, yeah.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
There is a version of this where you could say, because All Is Lost and Hightower Surprises can often be swapped mm-hmm. or moved around or stuff like mm-hmm. that, because they're very similar. So in one hand, I feel like this is a quintessential All Is Lost moment, but then the Act Three doesn't really work. Even though the next scene feels very, very much like a Dark Night of the Soul, but again, super abbreviated. There's
which
not a lot
also
of
feels stuff. Like the Dig Down Deep too. So,
which Dig Down Deep can feel that way as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, the end of this movie has me a bit befuddled, because I do feel like the All Is Lost. It is like the perfect All Is Lost moment. Like if you put this in a machine, if you put it in an AI or something, that is what it would come out.
That's what it would spit out. All Is Lost.
Boom. Yeah. That's what it is.
But yeah. I will say, Jamie, if you're looking at it, we talked about what the lock-in was, right? Cameron mm-hmm. and Michael and Patrick and basically Bianca now is on the team too, are trying to get Kat to go to prom so that Bianca can go to prom with Cameron. So that's the agenda, right? That's the A story. Technically, and it falls right in line at 75%, for Cameron, Bianca, and Patrick's plan, Kat refuses to go to prom at 75%. She's like, what's your real motives? She refuses to go to prom, and therefore Bianca can't go to prom with Cameron either. And that happens at 75%, right? The chance is now, I'm saying it fits the storyline. Like yes. The chances of them going to prom are lower than ever at that point. So from the A story, it does work in that way, but it doesn't.
Are you saying
like
that everything after that would be the third act then?
Yeah, like going to prom is the third act, because she ends up, Bianca talks to her and Kat reveals has the confessional and reveals what really happened with Joey, and then Bianca's like, you're controlling me, you're not letting me experience my own things, and you're not experiencing things yourself. And then Kat decides, oh okay, she will go to prom, and then that kicks into gear the new world, your typical arc plot story, new world. Okay, they're all going to prom together, and I think from then on, I tracked it. I think collectively it is a 5-point finale, but I do agree that it's weird that the Hightower Surprise feels more like your All Is Lost moment.
Can
like it's out of place.
Can you define Hightower Surprise for people, just because you guys have said it a million mm-hmm. times?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. People are gonna be like, who have never heard the string.
What
the
guy from Police Academy? Bubba Smith from Police Academy.
Jamie, you want to go through the five beats, and then I'll give examples.
Sure thing. And it's funny because that's how I experienced like learning Save the Cat when I first worked with Blake Snyder. He would just say these things, and I would just assume like everybody should know them. Like he'd be like, the bad guys close in, and I'd be like, okay, whatever. Because it was pre-book. It was exactly like that. And then the Hightower Surprise, and I'd be like, yeah, okay, whatever you call it. That's fine.
That's why I'm here, really. Yeah. What the hell are you talking about? I know what it is, but tell everyone else.
But that is exactly how it felt. I just kind of ran with it. I was like, okay, yeah. Hightower Surprise. Of course, we all call it that, right? So the 5-point finale. So in Save the Cat, in Blake's first book, it was just, he said, and then the finale happens, and then the closing image in the end. And he really didn't give too much instruction about, you know, he gave some basic instruction. So in his later book, again, his third book, he came out with a thing called the 5-point finale. And it was basically 5 points. These aren't necessarily scenes. These are just things that happen. They could all happen in one scene. They could be 5 scenes. This one, actually, they're probably spread out about 4 or 5 scenes. So if we assume that's what this is, which I can see the point. So here are the 5 points. Point one, gathering the team. There's usually some kind of preparation. Sometimes you have to bring people together. Sometimes you have to suit up. You have to get weapons. You have to make a plan. You have to look at maps, whatever that thing is. Gathering the team, that's number one. Two is execution of the plan. So whatever this plan is, whatever the goal is, they go and they do it. There's usually some kind of obstacle in the way or something, and they attack, for example, or something. And this, in the rom-com, it's different, obviously. So execution of the plan, whatever the plan is. And then the third thing, and the most important one, in my opinion, and the, mm-hmm. the thing that's most instructional toward people trying to write a finale, is the Hightower surprise. Things cannot go right in the finale. If your finale is just everything goes right at the end, it's almost pointless. It's like a capper scene or something. It's an epilogue, or, you know, something has to go wrong. Something has to go bad. And then the fourth point is a thing called Dig Down Deep, where they kind of, and this one can be long or it can be super short. It could be like a second, like 30 seconds, or it could be like a whole scene. And Dig Down Deep is usually kind of reflecting over the journey, coming up with a new plan, reformulating, not giving up. And then finally, there's execution of the new plan, with this, which is the fifth step. They come up with some new plan that kind of shows they've arced. It somehow reflects
turning off the targeting computer and using the force.
That's right. It reflects the fact that they've learned something along the way. And the reason they win is because they learned something along the way. And that's the 5-point finale.
All right. So now that we have all of those, the context for those points, I'm going to read what I think works. But yeah, it's one of these things where it's like, they don't all, it's not one person, it's all of them collectively. And so mm-hmm. we kind of get that same emotional experience of the ride. Gathering the team, Cameron picks up Bianca for the prom. Mm-hmm. As we know, that's the goal. And Kat reunites with Patrick outside the dance floor. There you go. They are at the prom. Executing the plan. They're at the prom. They're dancing together. Cameron and Bianca are dancing together, having a great time. That was the goal all along. Patrick is dancing with Kat, and he has secretly arranged for the singer of her favorite band that we saw earlier, how they bonded, to play a song and sing a song at the prom for her. I pulled a favor, and she's like, you know, she's so happy. Like, she's just like glowing. Hightower surprise. Joey spills the beans about the secret plan right in front of Kat. So it's like, oh shit. And Michael literally says, the shitteth has hitteth the faneth.
Yeah.
Dig down deep. Patrick admits to Kat that he was paid to date her, but that he didn't care about the money. He cares about her. And then executing the new plan is like a two-parter. Kat reads her poem in class, revealing her feelings about Patrick, and Patrick gives her the guitar she wanted and apologizes to her and tells her that he's fallen for her. So I do feel like that works, even though I agree that the all is lost really feels like, if you say it just like without looking at the movie closely, you'd be like, of course it's when she learns yeah. that the ruse, you know.
So yeah. My biggest problem with that is, though, I almost think they were operating closer to what you said, you know, like when they were thinking of their structure, they were thinking in terms of what you said. It honestly, it feels like the type of thing Blake would do in his book to justify Save the Cat in some ways.
Yeah,
like,
they'd
be like, they weren't using Save the Cat at all, but then they started to do it and they kind of fit. My biggest issue is, it makes for a very weak All Is Lost in some ways, because
mm-hmm, it does
for a couple reasons that I think are instructive. So I think her finding out the thing is a great All Is Lost. It fractures everybody's kind of screwed up in some ways. Like the sisters hate each other. The boyfriend is broken up. The only person, maybe Joseph Gordon-Levitt, ends up fine. You know, he still dates Bianca. So what does it matter? But in the earlier scene, one of the key things about An All Is Lost, and again, this speaks to who's the hero. Typically, An All Is Lost is something happens to someone. You know what I mean? Like something happens, and there's usually like this whiff of death. Like there's something, the death of a relationship, for example. And this one, it just seems like kind of a realization. It just feels like she's back to like, you know, why would you want to go to the prom with me? And kind of, and it feels like, it doesn't feel like anything really happened to her, except I can see where you could say something happened to them because she doesn't want to go. but I don't know. It's just weak. It's a weak. She also
says, boss. She also says, why are you pushing this after he says right. like one sentence?
Right.
like how much did she change is what I'm saying.
But I love pointing out that number one, these things are meant for brainstorming tools, how to get your story onto the page, and less yep. for retroactively trying to write one yep. for the movie. Yep.
That's number what two, I would say. Mm-hmm.
I love that we love this movie so much and kind of feel that whole emotional experience we are used to in a teen comedy arc plot Hollywood story. And it doesn't exactly fit. And it just goes to show you that you don't have to 100% fit the mold in order to tell a story that a general public will enjoy.
I think that's what I would like to say. Yeah. Like it works regardless of what you guys are saying right now.
Yeah.
It,
no, that's why
like,
I kind of
put it under this microscope. It makes it a bit weird, but yeah. it's not, it works though.
It sounds like we're trying to pull it apart, but we're not. I wanted to make sure that the listeners know that they're not. We're just saying like, it's a really interesting case. It's a case study. That's really weird.
There are some other like things when I watch this, like, and I don't know if it's because romance, like seeing Julia Stiles and Heath Ledger together, like there's some magic in it beyond logic. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like there's something about romance that those two have chemistry. So they should be together, even if logic doesn't dictate it in some ways. Mm-hmm. But there's a couple points in this movie where it feels like I hate to say this because I love this movie, but it feels like what I see in not bad screenplays, but new writers sometimes. And I'll give you a couple examples of that. One is when she tells her sister about having sex with the guy before. It feels to me like it doesn't feel like a thing it feels out of nowhere a little bit. Did anybody else strike? It didn't feel to me
something
Bianca's wanted, not Bianca, Kat has wanted to do the whole movie up until then.
Yeah.
So for me, it kind of works.
I think she feels earned. Yeah.
She literally says it at the party.
I have to tell you something.
I have to tell you something.
Yeah. And she's looking at Joey when she says
like,
it.
I feel like the scene you're talking about, Jamie, is a payoff to that moment for me.
Right. Yes. Okay.
So that works for me at least.
Because my feeling was it almost felt instructive. There was something about it that they wanted to say, you know, she makes it like that's her shard of glass in some ways, mm-hmm. right?
I mean, the movie is stating, I think.
I know what's weird about it, though. It's the fact that Bianca's already over Joey.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why it feels weird. Like, she's already past him. And then you tell her the big news about...
If she were still trying to go to prom with Joey, it would have hit harder.
It would have hit harder, yeah.
That's a good point, Bob.
And the only other thing I'd say is, it doesn't seem like... I mean, Kat's way over Joey. Like, she doesn't seem to ever even acknowledge him in the movie very much, does she? I don't think
they hate each other, and that's about it.
Yeah,
I see what you're saying, Jamie. You're saying it's very Joey-centric.
Yeah, like,
but it feels like, why would... Yes, I got you.
Yeah, and he doesn't seem to be too into her, and it just doesn't feel like there's a big history there that we need exploring.
So, it works for me, but I hear you.
I always thought it was weird to make that feel like her shard of glass. Like, it just didn't seem like anybody was hung up on it that much. It feels like very healthy. It happened with her and she was just like, I don't want that anymore, I'm done.
It's also sort of a payoff to a small line at the beginning of the movie when Bianca says, one day my sister just got tired of it and stopped.
Yeah
they, like, she doesn't
they
know why her sister
plant the seeds of intrigue.
Yeah, her sister
for
doesn't know
this question. Yes,
why did she become the quote-unquote heinous, you know, person that everyone dislikes? It's that answer. I'm not saying it's delivered at the right time in the movie.
That's the part I don't buy that's the answer. I don't know why.
And
that's the one part I always have. I'm like, I'm not feeling like that was her pain and her, you know what I mean? That she carried so long that she had to shun everybody. She felt like very healthy. She was like, I got over it 1 second. I told him if he ever told anybody, you know, and I was like, it seems like, she had an experience and she was done with it. It didn't seem like baggage, like the way it would need to be for that to be like her shard of glass. It just didn't land that way. I was like, okay, that's seemed like.
I think, okay, how about this? It's not so much the baggage with Joey. I think the type of people that Joey represents that she obviously has it out for her.
Right. The
she
social and the society she socially of the because villain, of it,
not,
right,
not
right.
personally.
Yeah.
She was, it's easy to throw him in the garbage, but she's like, people like him, they're out of my life. And my
but
sister's
it's also thematic.
She wants to be him.
She's like, know? She's kind of making out everyone else out to be like him when that's not the reality.
Not
like,
true.
That's kind of the whole movie is that. You no, know,
yeah.
Like,
Is there something I missed? Did he do something to her, or did they have consensual sex? She just was like, "That was a bad idea. I shouldn't have done it."
It's nothing like, yeah, it's something like that.
He never told anybody. He never lorded it over. This is the problem I'm having with it,
because of the penis thing. She says she basically blackmailed.
Right,
not
but for lack of a better term, I mean, he could have told people. He could have been horrible about it. He could have. Mm-hmm. He wasn't. So I don't.
Gotcha.
I don't get why she hates people when she chose. She made a conscious choice to have consensual sex. Didn't want to have it anymore, and that was it. That's the part I don't quite get. I don't know. To me,
well,
I don't necessarily need more trauma, but maybe I missed
something. Hold on.
She said he was pressuring her to keep doing it.
She was like, everyone else was doing it, and I did what everyone else was doing.
Everybody else was doing it.
And I decided that after that, I wasn't happy with my actions, so I'm not going to do what everyone else wants me to do.
Yes. A plus B equals C. I'm not going
to
do what everybody
Which to me is a very healthy thing. It's not a shard of glass. Like, it's a character arc already. Like,
right.
I'm not going to do something because other people.
It's like an arc of awesome kind of description.
I'm not arguing terms. I'm just saying I think that's why it works.
Yeah, I just,
you know what I mean? Like, that's, I think that's why it works, is that she doesn't want to do what other people expect of her anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Back then that she made that decision,
but she took it to the extreme, and she's like,
she did take it to the
like
extreme.
Not going to engage at all.
And he challenges that.
Yes.
So she go to the prom because no one expects you anymore, because you've taken it so far.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's,
but I hear what you're saying, Jamie. It doesn't really check your typical shard of glass box.
It feels like the spot where that should be happening, but to me it doesn't hit like, oh, I feel why she's like this, you know, like, no, it feels like, oh, she had a very healthy encounter that everybody was kind of cool, even Joey in some ways. I know she makes the joke that she had to blackmail him, but you know, he's done with her, she's done with him, she moved on, she learned a lesson.
You wanted it to be like a worse experience? That way she's like thrown into how she acts?
I don't know that I want it to be. I just don't know what that scene is telling me. Like, I'm not seeing the flaw and the wound and all the stuff that you typically see from that scene.
But I also think that
it's not a wound as much as it is a realization, is I want to be a certain way, you know? She doesn't want to be like everybody else. I think it wasn't like he broke me and I became this.
Yeah.
Just like, I realized this was more me.
And Jamie, I think when we get into the deleted stuff, you had some insight that I think is going to kind of also inform why they were careful with that scene and the way that they described it, and then really made it as tame as possible.
Right.
Given the concern of the audience.
There is some sexual politics involved with that.
Yes,
scene. I don't think they wanted to give Joey that much power.
Yes,
rightfully so. Like, it is a feminist movie, and I think
that's what I'm saying.
For 1999, for 1999,
that's what you put to words what I was circling around.
If you let Joey have all that power, then
it undercuts the movie
a lot. Yeah,
I guess. Yeah. I guess there's a part of me that wonders, like, if I don't know if that should be her origin story for the way she
gotcha.
Is in the first place. Gotcha. I just don't know. I don't know. To me, it's kind of odd, but
does she need an origin story? Does that connection even need to be there?
And that's the part we'll talk about in a couple seconds.
The other one, there's
another spot like that though, in the end, where in the end, you know, she's broken up with, you know, she finds out the ruse, the thing we labeled as the dig down deep. And she's kind of brooding. And then her father just kind of comes and he's kind of, he arcs. And that's enough to get her to come out of her funk, which also is a little weird.
It feels a little rushed. It does.
It feels like, but again, I sort of attribute that more to the magic of romance, you know, like that's, she goes and writes her monologue anyway. And it's from the heart, and she admits something in front of everybody that is hard for her to admit. So I'm sort of more okay with that, but it is a little pat almost that dad's like, hey, you can go to your college. Okay, great. It's like all the happy endings a little fast. You know, it's like,
yeah, it does feel a little rushed.
We got to get dad to say sorry, you know, but it doesn't necessarily feel organic to what happened. Like, it's not like dad sits down. Yeah, it's not like dad.
I think it works only because he says the thing the audience already thought.
Yeah, right.
Which is like Kat is already completely.
Yeah, you've had me on the bench. He says you've had me on the bench for years.
It does happen fast, but it totally makes sense. And, like, it reads like, yes, totally. Yeah. Bianca's still a child.
In a perfect world, like, that would almost inspire something in her, like, oh, that's what I've been doing with Heath Ledger, you know what I mean, or something. I don't know, but that's where it doesn't connect. And then there's not to bag on, but these are the things when I watched it, like, I was like, oh, these don't quite connect. It was one other thing. What was the one other thing that I saw this time?
The fact that Heath Ledger hires the band that she loves, and somehow
I don't microanalyze the that's
I don't mind it. It doesn't ruin the movie, but I'm also like, how come Kat's like, wait, you paid the band to show up, and you also got money for me to date me? Who's making money on this?
That's movie magic to me.
The finances of it don't make sense. I'm fine with it. It just doesn't make any sense.
In my mind, I was like, man, $100 goes a long way in 1999. I didn't remember that.
It's
kind of set up payoff. Maybe the band was just down on their luck and they needed a gig. So he could have, nowadays he'd just get her a cameo or something. And I got your cameo.
Here's an email with a video from them. I love you.
The other one that bothers me in this is when she says, my dad always wanted me to be like Bianca. And I'm like, no, he wants Bianca to be like you. That always bugged me a little bit too.
It's verifiably untrue because of the one scene where he's like, you have to be like her.
Time I hear that, I'm like, eh, no.
He likes the cat, doesn't want to date, and hates everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah, he doesn't want her to be like Bianca. I mean, what's Bianca like? She's kind of superficial and wants to date guys and cares about, you know, boys and boyfriends. He doesn't want her to be like that. It doesn't buy it.
But it's also something a teenager would say about their dad.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, them being kids
it's very authentic.
Understanding what your dad wants and not even listening to him, kind of. Yeah, I get it.
That's very authentic.
But I don't even see him being negative to her at all, except for the college thing. Like, he's very much like trusting of her. You know, if she'll go, then you can go, kind of thing. And it's, like,
he trusts her so much that her decisions are the basis of everything.
Everything, yeah. So anyway, that part always like sticks with me. But they're my grievances, my errands of grievances for 10 things I hate about you.
Oh man! All right, well, I'm going to go back to praise.
Okay,
Bob, I'm taking your part and just reading the next thing on the talking points. And I'll rush through.
Oh, I already thought you were doing it. So go for it. Do it up.
I want to talk about really quick Kat's monologue. I'm not going to quote it or read it, but for me, this is one of the most instructive things about the movie is, you know, you have a climax and you're trying to show when you're sitting there, you got the whiteboard phase. You're coming up with your ideas and you're like, okay, how do I come up with the big moment that is specific to my concept? You know, I always talk about the specificity being everything. And this is a high school teen retelling of a Shakespearean story, right? Mm-hmm. And what's the best way to have your climax of that? Kat reading a Shakespearean sonnet to express her feelings about, you know, her about Patrick, and to show that proof to the audience that she has learn to be vulnerable to others, you know, like they even do that great line where he's like, who's brave enough to share their work, to kind of remind us this is a bunch of teenagers who sharing your feelings at the front of the class is like the worst thing for a teen. It's like nightmare fuel for a teenager. And she's the one who doesn't share her feelings to anyone, you know? And so I just think it's a really instructive example of how to come up with a climactic moment that fits your movie. Like, what is the climactic moment that encapsulates what your premise is. And I think this one is a great example. I mean, it's even the title of the movie.
I was going to say, yeah, the movie's kind of named after it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that was all I wanted to say. That's all.
It's what you go, you pay to see the movie. To, is
yeah,
is
yeah, that but that's only. In the that's like in the it's premise delivery, right? Like right. That's totally. Like yeah,
yeah. And you could argue that's not it's not a list of exactly 10, but we'll get we're not going to leave that.
Jamie, is that another grievance? Yeah. There's eight
as a list expert. It's not a perfect 10, and it's a really big problem. It always has been.
Yeah, I always wondered about the 10 thing because. You know, a couple years.
He is going to go into.
No, a couple. I always wonder
there's
how.
It's only the top eight.
Like, is that a thing? It almost seems calculated, but truth be told, like eight simple rules came out, I think, after this, you know, for dating my daughter. But then was that based on a blog or a book? You know, so
it's based on something. I think it might have been a book, but.
Yeah. So I was always like, how calculated was that? Was that like a thing? And then they kind of made it work based on the thing they came up with, or was this in there? And then they named it after that. I'm always like, that's a question I'd like to ask them. If I ever see them again, I'd like to ask them that question. I'd be like, did the title come first or did the sonnet come first?
You know? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Good question.
We kind of touched on ensemble arcs already, right?
We did. We have like minimal time and we have a lot to go through. Yeah. So I'm not sure I need to go through it, but I did want to ask you guys, like, I feel like not only do they have their own individual arcs, but the group as a whole is circling around like one of David S. Freeman. There's a great seminar I went to and you can look up this guy. He has a blog named David S. Freeman's Beyond Structure. And he, in that seminar, gave out a list of like 40. It's like the extreme of Jamie's three arcs, which is 40 different, very specific character arcs that he gives examples from each movie, from movies for them. And he has this arc called Learns to See the Other as Equally Human. And I feel like this whole movie is an exercise in that, right? Like everybody who grows is growing because like before they had preconceived notions of the other people or weren't seeing the other people at all. And now they're all seeing that everyone has, they're coming of age. They're all seeing everyone has layers and all of their agents of change growth with each other. For me, at least happens because they learn to like the people have layers, you know, like, and they're not just this one thing. So I don't know.
I mean, they become adults almost during the movie. Yeah.
So, do you want to? Here's what I think we should skip to because this one's a long one. I think we should skip all the way to the deleted stuff.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of discussion in there.
Okay.
So, Bob, I don't know if you looked through the script at all. Did you?
Briefly.
Okay.
I used my time to watch the movie twice instead.
No, it's okay. So, one of my favorite things to do on this show, and we don't do it very often, is when we find a draft of the script out there that is not the final draft, and it's so different from the movie, and I just think it's so inspiring to see that there's a version of this movie that's not as good. And like just speak to the power of rewriting, right? So it's why, like you say, Bob, that's why we say the final cut of the movie is what we're considering the script for the ship.
It's also because that's what the audience has access to,
right?
We want everyone to be on the same page that we're talking about.
So the script, there's three big changes I want to talk about. The first one is the biggest, but there's two other things too. In the script, Kat and Bianca have a mom. And her character's name is Sharon. And what's funny is she is Miss Perky's character. So Miss Perky exists in the script, but she's very forgettable. She's the guidance counselor. All those guidance counselor scenes exist, but they're very, her side of it is very flat. And instead, all of the dick jokes and the comedic obsession about romance novels, all of those gags are in the same scenes that are already existing between Larry Miller and his daughters, the dad and the father. So you have all these dramatic debates and back and forth and scenes. And in the background, Sharon's just like, what's a better word for throbbing. Like he, the belly scene in the script, he's like, where the belly, where he makes Bianca wear the pregnant
right
belly. It, the mother's response is to be at her laptop and say, what's a better word for throbbing schlong? You know, like it's like, it's crazy how changing that one, like if you add her into all of those scenes in the final cut of the movie, none of them feel grounded. Like they all feel like ridiculous.
I think, you know, what it kind of goes into what I was saying about David Krumholtz, right? Like his part of the movie is the actual comedy part,
right?
Where the rest of it does feel completely kind of grounded, except for the Miss Perky thing.
So,
right.
Except for that, the David Leisure thing, they kind of like go to these asides of comedy, so, where the main people don't have that.
Two things about that. One is, the mother is like, honestly, if we saw this and the mother was there, when you read the script, the mother, it's almost like, why is she there?
She doesn't give a shit, right?
Yeah. She doesn't have an arc. She's not really part of it. Wouldn't she be, you know, what shouldn't she be, you know, why is she just sitting at, she's taking a knee. And it's funny, cause whenever I write movies with families, I almost always kill one of the parents off or have it a divorce or something, just cause I don't feel like writing two people. It's just harder, you know?
It is.
So, and this shows you why. And it's almost like she was an afterthought. She was there. She was just taking up space, and killing her off just gave it some more something. I will say that what I told Jimmy, there's the reason they said they removed her was more like a studio note. And it's funny because this is related to my whole thing about the Joey relationship and stuff like that. But they said that the studio wanted a better reason for why Kat was mad all the time, why she was so grumpy. They couldn't just have her. They wanted more of an origin, more of a reason, more of kind of a rooting resume material. You know, she doesn't have a mom, so we can be more on her side because it makes sense why she'd be grumpy and kind of, you know, antisocial and stuff like that. So a large part of why they cut that character was for that reason, according to the writers.
It also makes the dad way better, right?
Yes.
Like just having him be alone, and then it makes his fierceness towards
explains his neurosis, right?
Right.
Like
it totally
all of a sudden
does. Yeah.
You're like, I can see why this guy is like this, you know. Whereas if you have him and her with the romance novel together, and there's a hilarious scene in the script, you know, that scene where he's like looking at the balding hairspray ad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the script, he's just got home from delivering a baby and he's exhausted, and that he sits down on the couch and that ad comes on, and she's like, you want to watch Dr. Ruth? Like
right.
So it's just like, man, but
there's also like the unsaid story of the fact that he has two daughters. We kind of don't know what happened to the mom, you know, like he doesn't want them to have the same life that he has right now.
You know, sometimes you make a choice that you don't have to explain anything, right? Like
she by
just saying she left, it like explains so much about Kat's anger. And she never has to talk about it, and we get it as human beings. And it was just like such a great choice, and I think it's really instructive. And I'm working with scripts with clients all the time, you know, amateur writers who are trying to learn. And there's like always darlings, right? There's character darlings. There's like quirk darlings. There's just like you have these things that you fall in love with as the writer, and you're like, but they're not working for some reason. And this is like a great instructive way. They got to keep the romance novel comedic obsession, and they improved Miss Perky's character and made her do more than one thing. And then they improved the family, you know, the main family of the story, and they improved Kat so much just by taking that character out. So if you got a script, and as Jamie said, if they're just dead weight, if you have a character who's just not consequential to the scenes, how can you combine them with another darling, or just like rearrange? Consolidation is usually your friend, and this is a great example.
Less you have to feed too.
Yeah, yeah. Less human beings they have to pay. Yes.
Yeah.
One more thing that to Bob's point. So the other thing that they've said in interviews, the writers, was that the slapsticky, over-the-top comedy was all the director. So there's that scene with the bike going down the hill. Like, he just, he got to the set and he said, oh, that hill, we got to do something with that hill. And he, you know, so when he added that scene, and then the arrow to the butt, you know, that was his. So he, yeah, some of them are very, like, the arrow in the butt reminds me of Airplane. It's like a Zucker Brothers thing, right?
It's a bit tonally.
I was going to say, tonally speaking, I think the thing that stood out for me the most that I'd never realized until now, and I've seen this movie several times, was the cowboys.
Yeah.
Like, the absolute ridiculous of the cowboys. And there's one scene where in the background, they're all eating out of cans.
They're
of
eating beans.
I was like, that is like a joke from another tone of another type of movie. It's such an odd placement.
It's Naked Gun esque or
it's
something like that.
The cowboys are eating.
But I guess since it's in the background,
it's fine. It's like, it doesn't ruin the movie. Fine. But it's just an odd thing, you know? I was like, the rest of the movie doesn't track that type of humor.
I mean, the arrow to the butt is like that, but it cracks me up. I think it's kind of funny.
Yeah, no, I think it works.
All right, so there's two more I wanted to talk about because I think, once again, they're instructive. And I got to think this second one, maybe Jamie has in some insight from that Austin interview. Mr. Morgan, the English teacher, one of my favorite characters in the movie for multiple reasons. In the script, the English teacher is a character named Miss Blase, and she is blase. She's like a pushover. She's like a flat line of a character who, when Kat, the reason she's sending Kat to the office is because she can't keep up with her. Like, Kat's stronger. So Kat in the script doesn't have like an adult equal, intellectual equal in the school. And by changing the character to this like teacher who's strong-willed and simultaneously respects her, but also has like value for to teach her, like, you're not the, you know, your opinion isn't everything. And I just think it's such a simple thing, right? They changed the nature of his character. So that was another big thing. Like, imagine if every one of those scenes in the English class, like, it was just like a pushover woman, like, who's like, go to the office because she can't handle Kat. You know, I think it would have made Kat less of an interesting character. Yeah. It's just
it gives every one of those scenes a personality.
Yes.
The second, what's his name? Daryl Mitchell, the guy from Galaxy Quest.
Yeah, he's so good.
He's
same
so good
year, by the way.
Same year. Wow. Well, he was hitting it out of the park.
Yeah.
It gives every one of those scenes a personality would otherwise just be devoid of.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, and this could be totally wrong, but I think the director brought some people, because the director's a TV director. And if you look at the director, he has, I think his name's Gil Younger.
Yeah, yeah.
And, that sounds familiar.
And he has a million TV credits, like, you know, just Golden Girls and, you know, all these different shows. And I think he brought some people like Allison Janney and the teacher. He brought some of them in from his TV work, and then they were remodeled based on them.
So that explains some of those tweaks, but they're really good instructive changes. They make the movie better. So that's another case, like, where if your character isn't creating conflict, like Miss Blase was not creating conflict. She was just folding to Kat.
Set decoration. Right?
Yeah. So they made those scenes pop, like Bob said. Now the third one, and this is another one. I'm sure, Jamie, you've experienced this in your consultations too. So the original ending was the same, but then they have another scene, and it is, so you get all that emotional high and everything that we got where Kat and Patrick reunite. And then there's a scene at Kat's house, at the dad's house, and it's a barbecue.
It's a Fast and the Furious ending.
It's a barbecue at Kat and Bianca's house. And at the barbecue is Patrick, and he's cooking up veggie burgers and making fun of them. And then Cameron and Bianca are there, and they're having their talk. And Kat and Larry Miller's there, and Kat shows up with a yearbook. And it's Patrick's old yearbook from the previous year where he came from. And she's laughing, and she flips to his yearbook picture, and he's like all nerdy and has like glasses and his hair slicked back and a buttoned up shirt to like his collar. And they all make fun of him. And then it says fade to black. And I'm like, What?
That's weird. I feel like the whole he's a badass thing in the movie is so light. I don't think that would work at all.
No, but
because he's not that much of a badass.
Number one, it undercuts everything that they just achieved. Right. And like now they're making fun of him as a person and his appearance. And then the second thing is there's a thing where you want to get out as quickly as possible. The story's done and you want to get out. And I read scripts all the time where there's just like this extra scene that doesn't need to be there after we've had our big emotional high and we're so excited. And then the story just keeps going.
This one apparently had an after credit sequence where Samuel Jackson came up to Julia Stiles and said, have you heard about the Bourne Initiative?
No, the last scene should have been the logistics of getting an entire band on top of that building. You know that shot of the band on the building?
Yeah, that's another movie magic thing.
I would like to watch the making of that shot.
It actually looks really dangerous, too.
It looks super dangerous. Yeah. There's
no guardrails. It just doesn't look like you're supposed to be on that roof at all.
I bet they had to like find the structural integrity of that roof and like get somebody to estimate if it could happen.
But Jamie, real quick, do you have thoughts on like, you know, getting out as quickly as possible? You have any standard things that you tell people when you experience a script like that?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say I have like a quick handle for it or anything, but once you're done, always look to get out as quick as possible. You know what's tricky about a story like this is the fact that it is like a four-hander.
And
they're probably like, oh, we need to kind of wrap up Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Bianca, that's probably where their heads were in some ways.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't even be surprised that they didn't film that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just be like, we had to film something, because that's the only weird thing about this movie. And I think it works fine about it without it. But a lot of movies would try to do something that would wrap up everybody in some ways. And I think
the denouement, clapping,
the one you just described just doesn't sound very good. You know what I mean?
No, it wasn't. So the power of rewriting, super inspirational.
Yeah. I think that's everything.
Yeah.
I think we covered everything. Did you guys have anything else you wanted to add or say or plug?
I would just say if you got any questions for us, our email address is writersblockbusterspodcast@gmail.com.
I made an Instagram and a TikTok. If you want to follow it, you can.
I love how excited Bob is.
Not excited about it, but they exist and it won't be. Don't message us there. Do not message. If you find the Instagram and the TikTok, don't message those and expect me to respond. Okay. Email the thing. Don't do this, but you can follow them if you want to help us out. It's really to share tidbits and reels and stuff. So, Jamie, anything?
No, Last Night at Terrace Lanes is still out there. You can check that out. And if you're getting this the week of February, whatever it is, the 2024, I am doing that Save the Cat webinar for 2 weekends. So if you're interested, a lot of the stuff we talk about in this podcast informs what I talk about there. So if you're interested, check it out on savethecat.com.
Cool. All right. That's everything. Thanks for listening.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.
Hey, this is Bob Rose, and thank you for listening to Writer's Blockbusters. If you'd like to financially support the show, please consider joining my Patreon. I've been producing the podcast for several years completely out of pocket, and I'd like to keep producing it ad-free and no longer at a loss. If you'd like to help, head on over to patreon.com/BobRoseSucks. That's right, Bob Rose sucks. And if you want the one and only Jimmy George to help polish up that writing project you're kind of struggling with, head on over to scriptbutcher.com. As a listener, you already know he's the best there is, scriptbutcher.com. You can also support the show by simply sharing it or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate both. Thank you for listening and see you next episode.